Welcome! You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us. I'm very privileged this morning to be joined by Jorge Martí. He's the Secretariat of HENSAF Venezuela. Welcome to our program, Jorge.
It's a pleasure to be with you again.
It is with great concern that we watch as the recent aggression against Venezuela threatens not only the safety of the people in Venezuela, but also the shift that we were witnessing throughout Latin America of progressiveness, of more inclusive practices among governments. Can we talk a little bit about what the dangers of this aggression towards Venezuela has been and where we are today?
Yes, well, in fact, over the last 9 months, what we have seen is an attempt by Washington, the U.S. administration of President Trump, to overthrow the democratically elected president of Venezuela, Maduro, and to install someone else in power, this person called Juan Guaido, who's the president of the National Assembly. And this has been a very serious attempt. On the 23rd of January, Guaido, at a street rally, proclaimed himself as the president. He was immediately recognized by Trump and some of the right-wing governments in Latin America. Then on the 23rd of February, there was an attempt to violate the border of Venezuela in Colombia, in the Colombian border, which also failed. Then there was an attempt at a military coup when Guaido commandeered some troops and he called on the army to rebel on the 30th of April. That was also defeated. And throughout this period, we've seen a very belligerent stance by high-profile people in the U.S. administration, Marco Rubio, Mike Pence, Pompeo, Elliot Abrams. They were definitely decided to overthrow the government in Venezuela, and they've also tightened up the sanctions. For instance, at the end of January, they imposed sanctions on PDVSA. Later on, they've tightened sanctions. They've seized assets of Venezuela in the United States. They're basically trying to strangulate the country economically so that they will change the government and put a government that is to the liking of Trump and the U.S. administration. But I will say the most important thing is that in any other time in history, such an attempt, such a relentless offensive will have succeeded. And this time it has not. And I think that that's very important because it reveals two things, in my opinion. One, the enormous reservoir of anti-imperialist sentiment in Venezuela. I will say that there were even some people who were not particularly in favor of President Maduro, who didn't like the idea of Trump deciding in Washington, deciding who is the president of Venezuela. The attempt was so brazen, people didn't like it. A lot of people in Venezuela were not in favor of this. Despite all the problems that they're going through and everything, they didn't want the United States to decide who the government is. And the other thing that it reveals also, in my opinion, is the limitation of the power of imperialism. U.S. imperialism is obviously a very powerful force, and in the advance of the interest of U.S. big multinationals everywhere in the world. But however, at this particular time of crisis of capitalism, their power to impose their will on other countries has certain limitations. They can intervene, they can blockade, they can attempt a coup, they can put pressure. But after two very costly wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, which have been going on for many years now, nearly 20 years, which they haven't been able to win completely, there is no appetite amongst the American public for more foreign military adventures. And this has proven very costly for the United States in terms of lives lost, but also in terms of money invested. At this particular time, prepared to carry out an actual military intervention in any other country. So that means that while, as I said, while the power of U.S. imperialism is very strong and very dangerous, but it also has its limitations in the terms of what it is able to achieve.
For us in Latin America, sometimes the phase of warfare comes with the very benign phase of IMF loans, or you know the restructuring. They call it, you know, structural agreements, right? So we start to see our society change from the back, and yet it is disruptive. It is dehumanizing in many ways.
Yeah, yes, I mean, the power of U.S. imperialism is expressed in many different ways, not necessarily direct military intervention. For instance, Venezuela was providing fuel to Cuba, and what the United States have done is that, and this is, after all, on the face of it, this is an agreement between two free countries. Has nothing to do with the United States. Nevertheless, the United States have intervened. They have put pressure on the different oil tank companies so that they will not deliver this oil from Venezuela to Cuba. And now there are big problems in Cuba in relation to the supply of fuel. There's electricity blackouts as a result, and so on. Scarcity of fuel. So this is another way, through economic pressure, embargo, sanctions, is another way in which the imperialism expresses itself. But also, as you say, through economic policies. For instance, now we see how the IMF has brokered a multilateral loan to Ecuador worth $10 billion, US dollars. But this loan comes with conditionalities, so that the government has to implement a whole series of policies. The government is no longer free to implement the economic policies it so wishes, but rather it's dictated by the International Monetary Fund, a foreign institution dominated by the United States, which policies should it follow. And in this case, as it's always the case with the policies of the IMF, the policies that have been imposed, the policies of lifting subsidies on fuel, which hits mainly poor people, the mass layoffs in the public sector, cuts in social spending, attacks on workers' rights and trade union rights. That's a classic IMF package of policies, which has been implemented in Ecuador. Not so much because of the will of the Ecuadorian government or the Ecuadorian people, but as an imposition by the United States via the IMF. So that's another form of imperialism. And also, I mean, the very fact that the world economy is organized in the way it is, it means that a handful of big multinationals control the largest part of the world trade, and therefore they are able to dictate conditions on the countries that are dependent on imperialism, which is the big majority of countries around the world, the countries that export agricultural products or raw materials, sources of energy, and so on. They are completely dominated by U.S. Imperialism through economic mechanisms, the mechanism of world trade, which is an exploitative mechanism. And so at the end of the day, you see the few multinationals, most of them based in the United States, a few perhaps based in Europe, dominate the world economy and therefore dominate the fates, the lives, the livelihoods of hundreds of millions of people around the world who do not have a say in the economic policies that are implemented in the countries or in anything, really. They can elect a government. This government is completely dependent on imperialist domination. So yes, imperialist aggression and domination takes place, takes many different forms, from direct military aggression to diplomatic pressure, economic pressure, sanctions, and the domination of the world economy by a few multinationals through the mechanism of world trade.
At the recent United Nations Council, the VP for Venezuela spoke about the kind of aggression that the people of the world have faced under various presidents. But to me, it's even more interesting to think about the impact of blockades on countries, because this is almost a way of making a country invisible. So when the world doesn't even think of this country as worthy of presence, when the leaders walk out of a United Nations assembly and won't even listen, that's an act far greater impact, because you are not only dismissing the harm that has been caused, but you're also unwilling to even have others consider it or look at it. Can we talk about this practice of creating a country as the pariah, this entity to be avoided, not even be seen?
Yeah, I mean, this is the case with Venezuela very clearly. For many years now, 20 or more years, the U.S. government has attempted to overthrow the Bolivarian Revolution, to put it in simple terms. But if you go deeper, what this means is that the U.S. government thinks that they have the right to decide who the government of Venezuela is. That it is not for the Venezuelan people to decide their own government, but this is for the U.S. Administration to decide who rules the country. And in order to do this, they have to paint the enemy in the worst possible light. So for many years, they've been saying all sorts of things, that the Venezuelan government is involved in narco trafficking, the Venezuelan government is sponsoring terrorism, that the Venezuelan government is harboring terrorists, that there are Hezbollah terrorist cells in Margarita Island, all sorts of outrageous allegations for which they have never provided any proof. If you want to have an example, this is what happened at the United Nations General Assembly. The president of Colombia, Iván Duque, presented a dossier with pictures and so on, which allegedly proved the fact that Venezuela is harboring Colombian guerrilla groups, the ELN and others, and is giving them support. But in fact, as he was speaking and during the course of the UN General Assembly, what transpired was that these pictures were not taken in Venezuela. These were pictures taken in Colombia or in other places, and they did not prove what the dossier was stating. And this was such a big scandal, it was covered by the main media outlets in Colombia, that the president, that the chief of the of the intelligence service in Colombia had to resign over this, over providing the president with false pictures, so that he was spreading fake news, as they call it these days. So, I mean, this is just one other example. But the problem is this, that once they said anything, once they said that the Venezuelan government is involved in narco trafficking, once they've said that the Venezuelan government is involved in terrorism, this now becomes news. The capitalist media everywhere, which is also dominated by a handful of big capitalist media conglomerates, they repeat this as if it was news, without any investigation, without any questioning, without any critical appraisal of the information that they've been given. And so it becomes the norm. And so the general public in the United States, if you ask them, they will think that Maduro is a dictator, that the Venezuelan Revolution is a bunch of narco-trafficking, terrorist harboring, dangerous people. And why is this? Why do they do this? They do it in order to then justify things like this, embargo, blockade, military intervention, perhaps. So that if these people are so dangerous, well, then it's justified in the defense of democracy and human rights that we should intervene, and we should support someone else, and we should support this Guaido, and we should interfere in the internal affairs of Venezuela. It's all part of the same thing. The media propaganda and so on, the diplomatic pressure at the United Nations, it's all part of this offensive against the Bolivarian revolution that's been going on for the last 20, 25 years. And it's relentless. It doesn't cease, as you say, at the United Nations General Council, when the Venezuelan vice president was speaking, they walked out. And the whole number of countries walked out. Why? Because they have this pretense that the Maduro government is not legitimate, that the legitimate power in Venezuela is Guaido. But the small detail is that after 9 months of this campaign, Maduro is still in power, and Guaido is nowhere near the presidential palace. On the contrary, he's more isolated. Section of the opposition is now made a deal with the government. So that is what's happening. And that doesn't mean that the campaign is over or that it's less dangerous now. Sometimes when a wild beast is against the ropes, it becomes more dangerous. But we don't know what's going to happen next in relation to U.S. aggression in Venezuela. But certainly this is a campaign that's been going on for many years. And yes, economic sanctions do not make the headlines, but they have a massive impact. Venezuela is an oil-producing country. Oil represents about 90% of government revenues and a large part of its hard currency income. If you put sanctions on the oil company, then you're really hitting that economy. Up until now, there was a large amount of oil that was being exported from Venezuela to the US. Venezuela needs certain petrochemical products, dissolvents and naphtha, in order to refine its heavy, extra heavy crude oil into a product that can be then exported. And up until now, it was importing 90% of these products it needs for refining from the US. Just from that point of view, Venezuelan economy has been massively hit by these sanctions. But on top of this, the US is putting pressure on third parties, on other countries, on China, on India, on companies that deal with oil tankers, putting pressure on Cuba, on the Caribbean countries, so that they also introduce sanctions, so that they do not help Venezuela in any way, that they do not trade with Venezuela, that they do not buy Venezuelan oil. And this has a concrete impact. It has been calculated that tens of thousands of people have died in Venezuela directly as a consequence of these economic sanctions. And these economic sanctions, they don't make the headlines. As you say, this is a more silent way of strangling a country, but it's nevertheless a very painful way, and one that is designed to squeeze the country until it decides to have a government that is of the liking of the U.S. administration, which is a complete scandal.
It's a difficult situation to face under any conditions, you know, to face a blockade, not only a blockade, economic blockade, but also any kind of information. When we look at Venezuela, we hear one story, right? And that's the story that the U.S. wants to promote. What is the spirit on the streets of the people? How are the Venezuelan people responding?
Well, it's difficult to say. There's obviously different opinions amongst the people. Quite a lot of people have had to emigrate. We're talking about millions of people who, faced with a very difficult economic situation, have decided to go, leave the country and try to look for jobs in Ecuador, in Colombia, in Peru, in Chile, and other places. At the beginning, these were mainly middle-class people who supported the opposition, and they fled to Europe or United States. They had the economic means to do it. But more recently, we've also seen working-class people from poor backgrounds, making the journey overland through Colombia, trying to find a way out to this very difficult situation, which the sanctions have only aggravated, of course. Then there is obviously another section of the population who, as I said, there's a large percentage of people who, above all, they do not want imperialist intervention. They have seen the experience of what happened in Libya, what happened in Iraq, what happened in Afghanistan when the United States went in, all guns blazing, military imperialist intervention, promising human rights and democracy. And the last thing that they have is human rights and democracy. These countries are destroyed. They have no governments. In Libya, there are open-air slave markets in the beginning of the 21st century. It's a completely scandalous situation. So the people in Venezuela are very aware of this. There's a very strong feeling of resistance against imperialism. At the same time, there are many people who are skeptical or doubtful about the policies or critical about the policies of the government in relation to, say, land reform or workers' control. And there's a very strong body of opinion within the Bolivarian movement that say that we must go back to the genuine Bolivarian policies as proposed by Chavez. And there is a lot there are, and they say that there are a lot of reformists and bureaucrats who are sabotaging the Bolivarian revolution from within. Of course, there is also a section of the population who become demoralized, despondent, they're not participating in the movement anymore. And of course, there is a hardcore of opposition supporters who some of them, I would say, a big part of the opposition supporters, who perhaps represent a third of the country's population, are actually in favor of a military intervention. They don't see any hope of transforming the situation in their favor on their own, and they're getting impatient that Trump is not ordering a military intervention. Now, this is a very dangerous point of view and a very naive point of view. If there was a military intervention, no one will be spared, regardless of whether they support the government or the opposition. I'd say that what's most hopeful about the situation in Venezuela is that there is a large layer, perhaps not a majority, but a significant layer of the population, the grassroots of the Bolivarian Revolution, who are resisting, who are organizing, who are trying to face off imperialist intervention on the basis of the self-organization of working people in the countryside and in the cities.
Latin America is very familiar with U.S. interventions. What makes Venezuela unique in its ability to withstand their terror and their aggression?
Yes, it's true. I mean, if you look at the last 100 years or perhaps 150 years, you will see a long list of countries that the U.S. has intervened in, either through sending the Marines or through the U.S. Embassy organizing a military coup with the local armed forces and removing left-wing or progressive governments, left, right, and center in countries like Guatemala, in Nicaragua, in Chile, Uruguay, in Paraguay, in Brazil, in Argentina, everywhere, in Peru, everywhere, really. In Venezuela, they have tried. They have tried very hard since 1998, when President Chavez was elected for the first time in a democratic election, in democratic presidential election. They have tried very hard to overthrow this government. They were behind the coup in 2002. They were behind every single opposition rioting, attempted military coup through sanctions and so on, and they have failed. And I think, as I said at the beginning, this reflects two things. One, the depth of the revolutionary process in Venezuela, how far the masses have gone, how far they are identified with this revolutionary process, how far this revolutionary process has given them, in terms not only of increased living standards, housing, education, healthcare, but also in terms of self-pride. People who were never part of the political process before, they now feel that they control their future, futures in their own hands, they decide. And many of them, over a period of time, they occupied factories, they occupied the land, they run it under workers' control and so on. That's what gives Bolivarian Revolution its strength, its radical character, is what allows it to withstand the offensive of imperialism. The other thing is also that in this period of time, imperialism has been weakened. It's not that it's weak, but it's been relatively weakened as in comparison to what it was before. The military interventions in Iraq and Afghanistan have been a failure from all points of view, and they have not brought stability, peace, or human rights, which were the alleged aims of these interventions. And this is a reflection of the relative weakness of U.S. imperialism, because imperialism is based on the economic power of that particular country, and capitalism is in crisis. It's in crisis since 2008, particularly. It's about to enter into a new recession. All this makes it more difficult for the U.S. to control the world, a world which is now much more unstable, a world that is in crisis, a world where people are rising up against the capitalist system, against imperialism, against domination, So I think that all these factors have contributed to the longevity and the resilience of the Bolivarian Revolution, which is quite an extraordinary phenomena.
Thank you so much for being with us today. And I believe that the people of Venezuela continue to be an inspiration to other nations who feel also under attack. And I think that it's also an example that sometimes difficult times are also learning and growth times. So perhaps at the chagrin of the U.S., this experiment has only served to reinforce people's resilience and ability to withstand, you know, and to defend what they have created.
Yeah, I think that's the case. Also, from a more general point of view, when the Bolivarian Revolution started in 1998, it also sparked a whole series of revolutionary events in other countries. We saw in Ecuador, in Bolivia, in Mexico, in other parts, there was a general advance of a revolutionary wave throughout Latin America. After 2014-15, these governments, which had been in power for some time now, and they were relying mainly on the high oil and raw material prices in order to carry out massive social economic programs, entered into crisis, and some of them were defeated in the polls, including in Venezuela, where we lost the control of the National Assembly, but also the electoral defeat in Argentina, in the removal of the president in Brazil, and so on. But now, which is what, 5 years later, in some cases 4 years later, we see that this was not so much the fact that people were shifting to the right and were voting for conservative or right-wing governments. It was that there was certain demoralization with the fact that the left governments had not fulfilled all of their promises. Now we see how, in the face of really aggressive austerity measures being implemented by these right-wing governments, people are turning again towards the streets, towards a mass movement, in order to defeat them. Macri has been defeated in Argentina. There's been big movements of the students, the youth, and the workers in Brazil against Bolsonaro. And right now, as we speak, in the last 4 or 5 days, there's the beginning of a mass uprising in Ecuador, where the government of Moreno has implemented an IMF package which affects a majority of the population. So I will say that the fact that the Venezuelan Revolution has survived through this very difficult period puts it now in a very favorable conditions at the beginning of a new revolutionary wave. Lessons need to be learned from the mistakes of the past, but also there needs to be a recognition of the resilience of this revolutionary process. The people in Latin America, the workers, the peasants, the poor, the oppressed, they have no other solution than the struggle and to move towards the transformation of society in order to guarantee the basic rights.
We leave it there. Thank you so much for being with us today. Thank you for all your work. How can people access your work?
Yeah, it was a pleasure to be with you. And we have a website, the Hands of Venezuela website. It's called handsofvenezuela.org. You can find links and information. I'm also on the editorial board of the In Defense of Marxism website, which provides socialist analysis and ideas for the labor movement and the workers' movement internationally. And that's marxist.com.
Thank you again for being with us.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com.